Many are betting that streaming music services will be the future of the way we listen to tunes. Big-time companies such as Apple, Google, and Amazon are doling out the big bucks in a race to control the industry, which could save services such as Pandora and Spotify, which have been unable so far to make much of a profit. With us now to talk about the future of music streaming is John McDooling, corporate reporter for Quartz. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. Good to have you here. I'm almost getting to the point where I want to lead a crusade to bring back vinyl.
Well, it's interesting. The vinyl is actually one part of the recorded music business that's growing. Vinyl is actually doing quite well. It's coming off a low base, but vinyl record sales were up around 40% in the first 6 months of the year, according to Nielsen. Now, the only part of the industry that's growing faster than that is streaming. Consumers are increasingly comfortable with the concept of streaming music online and the concept of paying a subscription to sort of get all you can eat on a monthly basis, and that's coming at the expense of digital downloads and CD sales.
Let's step back a little bit. Explain for our listeners the differences between the on-demand services, you know, iTunes, what have you, MP3s, and internet radio and streaming.
Yeah, so the music business has been gone through a rapid transformation over the past decade. Obviously, the first big sort of disruptive force was iTunes, which gave people the ability to buy individual songs rather than full albums.
I finally figured iTunes out, and I'm a big user. So
yeah, now that sort of business is also falling away, and people are using services like Spotify or Beats, which has just been acquired by Apple. And paying a monthly subscription to get access to, you know, huge libraries of music. The other part of the internet streaming business that's growing is internet radio, and the biggest player in that segment of the market is Pandora. So one way to think of it is services like Pandora are actually competing with commercial radio. And services like Spotify and Beats are competing with sort of physical music ownership. They're a bit like Netflix for music, and they're basically replacing sales and downloads of music. People don't sort of see the need to own music anymore when you can stream it online, and usually when you pay a subscription, you can stream it offline as well.
Who's using these services? What are the demographics? If you're able to tell.
I think they're definitely skewed towards music enthusiasts. There's no sort of real information on what ages they are, but at the moment, the people who are adopting these services are the real music lovers. The challenge for the industry is to grow that out and to increase the penetration to levels in places like Sweden, where Spotify is actually from. The penetration rate is extremely high, and the music business there is actually growing, which is not really everywhere else in the world. It's shrinking. And the reason why it's growing in Sweden is because the cost of these subscriptions, a Spotify subscription works out to about $120 a year. That's actually more than most people spend on their music, even in the heyday of the record business before the internet was even around. It's actually more money. So there's actually an opportunity for the music business to grow and for artists and songwriters to actually make more money if enough people embrace this streaming model. And that's the big challenge for the industry at the moment. Now, the problem for that is that there's so many people competing for a slice of the pie at the moment. We have, obviously, just in the on-demand music space, you have Spotify. Everyone's waiting to see what Apple's going to do with Beats, which it spent $3 billion on earlier this year, and Google as well is entering the space. YouTube is reportedly going to launch a subscription music service of its own. So it's a pretty competitive space. at the moment, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
I mean, I'm reading that it's been very hard for companies such as Pandora and Spotify to make money from music streaming, and yet you see Apple, Google, Amazon, as you mentioned, you know, going headlong to try and purchase these services. What's in it for companies like Apple and Google and Amazon?
Yeah, so certainly for Apple and Amazon, Google's a little bit different, but for Apple and Amazon, music is really a tool to, like a strategic tool to convince people to buy other stuff. It's a bit like the days of when Best Buy had discounted CDs in their stores to get you in to buy consumer electronics products. It's kind of a loss leader for Amazon wants you to sign up for Prime, their home delivery service, and order a lot of products. Apple wants you to buy more iPhones and iPads and their consumer electronics devices. And Apple's had a long relationship with music, with iTunes, and one of the reasons why a lot of people stick with Apple or have over the years is because it's really difficult to get that music library. Once you purchase iTunes music, it's impossible to get it out of Apple and onto another device made by a rival company. So there's a strategic value for these companies with music.
Do you see, you know, and of course, you know, when CDs replaced cassettes, you know, cassettes pretty much started to disappear, although not completely. But do you see in of course, you know, records, you know, kind of started to go that way as well. But as you said, vinyl is really making somewhat of a comeback among audiophiles and music lovers. But do you see the MP3s and you know, iTunes going in that direction, or even indeed going away?
I do. I don't. I, as a consumer, I don't see the need for why a consumer would want to continue to pay to download music. Because I mean, there's an emotional attachment to vinyl, and that probably explains. Its resurgence, and there's the physical element of owning vinyl. For digital music, it makes sense to, you know, for the price of an album, you can get a monthly subscription to a streaming service where you can have access to more music than you've probably ever had before in your entire lifetime. So that is why we're seeing such rapid growth in this industry at the moment. It's kind of consumers are winning at the moment from this revolution, whether or not musicians, artists, and even the companies are winning yet, is sort of still up for debate.
So put yourself in the shoes of somebody that's with, you know, that's in the MP3 industry or iTunes. How do you respond? What do you do? Do you suddenly slash your prices and say, hey, don't go away, we're gonna cut the price from 99 cents a tune to 50 cents a tune. I mean, what do you do if you're in their shoes?
Well, I think it explains why Apple spent $3 billion this year buying Beats Electronics, which has a headphones company, but it's also most analysts and most observers of Apple believe they bought that business because of its streaming product and because of the people that run that streaming product, which is Dr. Dre, the rapper, and Jimmy Iovine, the well-connected producer. So obviously, you know, Apple, which was the biggest player in downloads, sees a future in streaming, and Google's is taking similar steps. And that's obviously, you know, the two biggest companies in technology. That's how they see the future of this music business playing out.
One of the issues that came up very early on when iTunes and a lot of the MP3s started to come out, and it had been around somewhat even prior to that with, you know, pirated CDs and even back into the cassette, you know, era, you know, pirated music. How have music piracy sales or rates been affected by music streaming? What kind of an impact is this going to have, and are we going to see less piracy as a result of this move towards streaming?
Yeah, so that experience, if the experience of Sweden is anything to go by, again, that's, they're sort of a forward-looking market, and that's where Spotify is from. In Sweden, Spotify attributes its growth in subscribers there and usage there to people abandoning piracy and adopting its services, because there are risks in people using piracy to obtain music. There are risks. For starters, it's illegal and you can get in trouble for breaking the law, but there's also sort of risks around malware and viruses and things like that. And once you have a product like Spotify or any of the other on-demand streaming services, which are extremely convenient from a consumer point of view, and they do also have a free options, typically free options that are advertising supported, so you can still have access to these massive libraries of music. And if you're not paying for it, you are just subjected to some ads. Once a product like that emerges, it makes piracy increasingly redundant. The amount of effort you have to go to obtain all this music through piracy is kind of redundant when you can access it for free and listen to a few ads, or you can access it and pay a small amount each month.
Got the pirates saying, why even bother? I think I'll go into another line of work.
Yeah. I mean, that's the big hope for the music business, if they can attract enough people away from piracy and to adopt and to actually pay for music again, where they're paying directly by paying a monthly fee or by subjecting themselves to ads, then the music business can return to growth again, which it hasn't been in for quite some time.
What do you hear from the music industry and the musicians themselves? I mean, how do they view streaming as opposed to a lot of the concerns they had over MP3 sales and iTunes and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a big debate in the artistic community at the moment. Some people are fans of the model. Typically, the younger artists are embracing the model. Some high-profile artists, notably Radiohead's Tom York, have been highly critical of Spotify and the amount of remuneration they get from that services. Earlier this year, I spoke to a famous producer, Steve Albini, who produced records for Nirvana and the Pixies, and he was basically saying that he thinks the musicians' opposition to these streaming services is misguided, and that this is an opportunity for people to get remunerated for their work again, and it's just a new revolution, and everyone should get on board with it. That being said, it's still early days for these products in terms of their adoption by consumers. Pandora has also had some difficulty, not so much with the artists, but with the record labels and the publishers over the amount of royalties it pays. And I think we can expect these sort of disputes to continue for some time until the industry gets such scale that it's completely dependent on these services for its revenue. So until we see these services completely replace CD sales and downloads, there's still some way to go before that happens. But it's probably going to be an issue for a while.
Well, John, we're running up against a break here, and I want to thank you for joining us. I never thought I'd think that my iPod was suddenly old school.
Things change pretty quickly in the technology.
Oh my
industry
gosh, it's
these
like
days.
Like changes in 24 hours. This was we've been talking with John McDooling, the corporate reporter for Quartz. John, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. Have a good one. And coming up, we'll be talking about applications that can keep your kids entertained during vacation travel time. Ah, yes. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann Fisher. Family vacations are for fun activities and creating great memories, but they can be bogged down with long travel times with restless kids, whether you're driving, flying, or taking the train. And how many of us haven't been driving along saying, "Don't make me come back there"? Anyways, now with the explosion of cell phone and tablet apps aimed for users of all ages, parents have a new weapon to combat bored children. Oh, humanity. Joining us now to talk about applications for traveling children is the editor of TechWithKids.com, Ginny Goodmanson. Welcome to the show, Ginny.
Thank you, Stu, for having me.
And let me preface, too, by saying, you know, for our listeners out there, if you have a kids app to recommend, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you've got a kids app that you just think is the greatest thing since sliced bread and want to recommend it. Ginny, I'm not sure of what generation you hail, but I remember driving on vacation or going on vacation with my parents, and my favorite game was identifying license plates, and that usually kept me fairly occupied. But today it's just, you know, holy cow! It's like there's this huge array of things that you can give your kids to do, and a lot of which I wish I had, you know, when my kids were little.
Yeah, no, Stu, and I agree with you. I also had kids that did the exact same thing. They were playing the license plate game as well, but now there's a new way to go at, and they used to play travel bingo, but now there's a new way to go by about this stuff. And it's a little bit easier because instead of loading those crates of activities into the car when you're traveling, you just need that iPhone or a tablet and you're all set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the best part about it is that you at least head off the possibility of the kids in the back seat going, "Make her stop touching me."
So. Exactly. And the key here is that, you know, unoccupied children tend to do things that we don't want to have happen. So I look at all the different apps that for kids in a lot of different categories. And for travel, it's kind of a fun way to go about it because if you can load your device up with a variety, you come prepared for various times of those travel lag times. And let me share just a few with you, Stu, in the sense that one of the ones that I put on this list of, you know, apps for traveling kids is I specifically look for that app in the late afternoon when everybody's been in the car too long and everybody's antsy. And what you'd really like to do is, you know, be able to just send the kids out into a park to go run. Well, believe it or not, there's an app that sort of helps with that antsiness, and it's called Finger Hula. Is that the craziest concept ever? But the idea is that you're going to actually have, well, it's not great physical activity, it's actually physical activity with your fingers. So again, by getting your kids to focus on doing something physical, they sort of settle down a little bit. And this is a puzzle game about spinning hoops. And when you do it by, with, you know, doing a circle with your finger on the screen of your phone or your tablet, and the idea is that by spinning it slower or faster, you're trying to hit the appropriate gauge in which the game is asking you to spin at, and when you do, you create music. So it's a kind of an unbelievable, you know, just a really interesting combination that works very well for travel situation.
That's interesting. You know, I would never have thought about that, but thinking back on travels that, you know, that I went on as a kid with my parents, and then the ones subsequently where I was in the driver's seat and my own kids were in the back seat. You're absolutely right. It was that kind of, you know, late afternoon, "Ma, I'm tired. I want to, you know, Dad, I'm tired. I want to stop. Can we do this? Can we do that?" And, you know, or there would be the inevitable poking, or "She's on my side," and "Make her move," and that sort of stuff. So,
yeah, that's when you want that sort of novel app. And so that That one, Finger Hula, I think is a good one. It's on both Android and the iOS, which is the Apple devices. So, you know, pretty much anybody can download it, and it ranges from 99 cents to $2.99, depending on which system you're on.
No, so, that's not bad. And,
yeah,
and let me remind people that if you're listening and you're interested in this thing, can they go to your website, techwithkids.com, and learn more about these?
Absolutely. So techwithkids.com, Stu, has all sorts of rec lists, which makes it really easy for parents. You know, we do a lot of research. So when we're going to create the, you know, apps for traveling kids list, we've looked at hundreds before we select maybe the 10 that go on the list. And that's true across the board, from the best app for preschoolers, if you have a dinosaur lover, all the way up through grade school. We try to separate it and make it easy for parents to figure out what's the best, so they don't have to waste a lot of time with, you know, over 500,000 apps out there for kids. It's just very complicated for parents. So we're trying to make it easy.
That's good, because as with anything, whether it's, you know, apps for kids or apps for anything else, there's just this huge field out there, and it is very difficult as a parent to try and sort through, you know, what's good and what's not so hot. So,
right.
Let's kind of go down through some of these different apps here. And let me remind people, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Clearly, I am not Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, but subbing for Ann on 89.7 NPR News. And if you'd like to call in, you can call us at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you've got perhaps an app that you like. But let's run down through some of these. State Bingo and Road Trip Us, Road Trip US. Let's start with that one. In this app, Pep the Car apparently teaches kids geography with two different game options. So tell us a little bit more about this and how this works.
Sure. So, you know, you're going to tell your kids to fasten their seat belts and rub up their brain cells on this one. So it comes with two different kinds of games. Both are related to geography and travel. The first is a regular bingo game, but the difference is that this bingo game is being conducted by the 50 states. They're going to ask you riddles about themselves, the states are. And when, you know, you answer the riddle correctly, then you get to mark that space on your bingo board. So, you know, one state might say it's the home of Death Valley, and so then the kids need to try to figure that out. The nice thing about the app is there's a big, huge map that they can study at all times, so they can go try to figure out the answer, which I like, so that they're learning in the process. The other game in this app is called Road Trip, and the concept behind that is that you start at a certain state and you're given a destination state, and then you need to map out how you're going to get there. And each time you want to cross into a new state, you again have to answer a question. So that's where the trivia, the geography is happening. And you get, depending on what level you're playing on, which is nice about this app, you can play it at three different difficulty levels. So it spans a wide range from, say, age 7 to maybe age 14, because you can adjust the difficulty level. Anyway, you play, and if you get a wrong answer, you get a flat tire, and you only get four flat tires. Until you have to start again, so it's kind of cute.
Well, it's kind of interesting that it keeps kids, you know, occupied by really kind of challenging their intellect as well.
It does, absolutely, and that's one of the ones. I think that's always the best. If you can have a children's app that is thoroughly engaging and happens to be teaching them something while they're at it, wow, that's a win-win as far as I'm concerned.
Kind of continuing on that road trip theme, there's another app called Road Trip Bingo HD. What's that like? How does it work?
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of road trip bingo apps in the app store, so be careful if parents listening are looking for this one. This one actually has hyphens between each of those names, road-trip-bingo. And it's by a company called Bright Bunny. Now, the reason we like this one more than any of the others is that this has, first of all, the artwork is wonderful and self-explanatory. A lot of times these bingo boards are complicated, and kids have trouble figuring out what that's, you know, what they're supposed to be looking for. This one makes it very easy, but it also has a two-person option. So, perfect for the family with two kids.
Mm-hmm.
Or even
siblings
that doesn't want to play by themselves, right? Mm-hmm. You can have two boards displayed on the screen, and that's true. This is for the iPad version. There is an iPhone version, but there isn't just enough real estate on the screen to do two for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the iPad version actually allows two players to be doing bingo by looking out the window, you know, looking for the white car, the red car, the railroad crossing, that sort of thing.
Kind of a little more sophisticated version of, you know, I see in my eye, you know
yes.
that sort of thing. So anyway, yes. We actually have we've got a caller, Bostwick from Worthington. You've got a game that or an app that that is good for kids. Tell me about it.
Yeah, just a good turn on that radio. It's called Lightbot, LIGHTBOT, 1 hour of code. I never heard of it but until my 6-year-old granddaughter told me about it. And it actually writes she writes little computer programs to make a robot jump around on a pile of blocks and turn lights on. And she's very good at it. And so the 1 hour version has subroutines and maybe a small loop.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think once you do that, I mean, that one's free. Then for $2 or $3, I mean, I'm on an iPad, so I don't know what the Google version does, but the you can buy more expensive ones, which are probably too hard for my 6-year-old granddaughter. Almost too hard for me, right?
You'd be surprised how fast they pick it up, too. Yeah,
it keeps on going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me ask Jenny about this. Jenny, is this one that you've heard about?
Oh, absolutely. And your caller is right. These coding apps are very popular. We have covered a lot. I've looked at personally a lot of them. Lightbot is one, and another one that I really like is called Tinker, T-Y-N-K-E-R. So you might look at that one as well. What we talked about earlier, Stu, it turns this learning environment into a game. So kids think they're playing a game, but they're actually really learning how to code. And wow, what a powerful, powerful way of learning when it becomes something that they are in control of.
Let's go down through this list some more here. Chatter Picks Kids. What's that all about?
Yeah, so that's a really fun free app. It's from a group called Duck Duck Moose, and they've done just a whole series of really, really top-notch kid apps. So in this one, what's funny and exciting about it is kids can use the camera of the device, and they can take a picture of anything. So let's say you're in the car and they take a picture of their shoe, their tennis shoe. Then all they have to do is draw a line to represent where they want a mouse to be on this inanimate object. Then they can start to talk for the object. So they record something silly like, gosh, Dad, how many more miles do we have to go or something, right? And then...
are we there yet?
Yeah. You push play. And then this inanimate object becomes animated and talks. It is hilarious. So, the fun about this one is that kids get to use their imaginations and creativity in terms of what do they want to photograph, and then what stories do they want this object that they photographed to tell. So it's really very amusing and very simple to use. So it's again, I think this is a great one late in the day when you've kind of gone through everything else.
Okay, now here's one. That's Baloney.
Yeah. Funny name, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah, it's a kids quiz game, and it's obviously got a food theme. But what we always found when we're traveling as a family is it's fun to do sort of family trivia games, but so often kids are left out of the mix because they just don't have the knowledge base. Well, this is a way for parents and families to enjoy 2,500 kid-appropriate educational questions. And it's divided, the app actually divides the questions from sixth grade down to second grade. You can even select the subject matter if you wanted, or you can just, you know, have it be random. But anyway, it's a kids can play it by themselves. They can play it together with the other siblings. They can play it as a whole family. What I like is that you have this set of questions now where the kids can feel empowered because they can answer them.
We've got maybe about a minute or two left, I think, but let me move on to one last one called Paper Ocean, which it says here is kind of designed for craftier kids.
Yeah, so this is, believe it or not, origami on a tablet or a phone. And the concept here is that kids learn how to fold animals, and in this situation, they're all ocean creatures. And then after they fold them by using their finger to, you know, do a crease, and then they use their fingers to move and fold things over. And after they finish, the animals actually come alive when you drop them into the virtual ocean. And you can play games with them. And so it's a really fun, enclosed app, which actually takes a fair amount of time to actually fold all 20 animals, and then you can play games with them. Like you can play soccer with a crab as your goalie. It's really lots and lots of fun.
That really sounds like a lot of fun. Well, and I guess briefly before we let you go here, these are also apps. You don't necessarily have to be driving in a car or have your kids in the back seat to have fun with them.
That's right. All of these are fun on their own. We just tried to come up with a list that is actually a wide variety of different kinds of apps to keep kids entertained.
Well, and let me repeat, the website is techwithkids.com, and Ginny Goodmanson is the editor of techwithkids.com. It's a digital magazine of technology products for children. And Ginny, thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time. It's been a delight.
Thank you, Stu. Nice to meet you.
And you too. You take care now. And coming up, we'll be speaking with Geek.com's Russell Holly about recent updates in the technology world. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann Fisher this week. From new body parts to weaponry to the food on your kitchen table, 3D printing is all the rage and the technology, seemingly, of the future. But many 3D printers start off at close to $1,000, and that's just the printer. Now there's a new service that will print your 3D designs and mail them to your house. Joining us now to talk about that and all that is tech is blogger for Geek.com, Russell Holly. Russell, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. Listeners, if you have any tech or gadget-related questions for Russell, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, this 3D printing that's available through Amazon.com. How does this work, Russell?
Well, Amazon has been trying to sell 3D printed products for a little while now. And mostly they sell the printers and the filament that goes into it. And they have, over the last year, grown quite a sizable collection of the models that they sell and the filament that's available for each one of those models. But when it comes to, you know, the things that can actually be made with 3D printers, there are tons of other sites, Etsy, eBay, places like that, where you can buy, products that other people have made using 3D printers, and Amazon wanted to cover that. So to do that, they have adjusted their 3D printing section to include products that can be printed by third party, but then also you know, customized by the user before they are shipped out.
What's the cost for this?
Well, it really varies based on what product you're buying. You know, there's a company that makes bobbleheads that you can, you know, customize to look like really whoever you want. And those, you know, are $20 to $30. They have cufflinks that you can have personalized that are a little more expensive because those are you know, metallic. So it really definitely varies based on the product. But it can be as little as, you know, $10 to $15 and as much as several hundred dollars, depending on what you're ordering.
What kind of consumer response are they seeing for this? Is it, you know, something that's just starting to bubble up, or is it really pretty solid?
It's only been up for a couple of days so far, but the response seems to be really positive initially, and that's a big part of, you know, why Amazon did this in the first place. There's so many other services that are offering something similar, and in most cases, not even quite as expansive as what Amazon is offering now, because the Amazon tool set is now set so that retailers can actually go in and upload, you know, three-dimensional images and whatever options they want to be able to customize. And it creates a very nice interface for the retailer so the users can go in and personalize how they want. And it's a very nice, you know, 3D panel that you can go through and, you know, kind of look at every dimension of the item that you're buying before you go and buy it. And, you know, personalize whatever you want. They have, you know, cell phone cases that you can have, you know, your name placed on, cufflinks that you can have, everything from, you know, emoticons to your initials engraved on them, printed as a kind of an overlay on them, and then, you know, shipped out. I haven't seen much in the way of Amazon Prime shipping available for these, but, you know, shipped out with many of the same shipping features that Amazon has for almost everything else.
What are the limits of this? You know, either in terms of size or things that Amazon is willing to reproduce. I mean, you know, I'm thinking. I mean, you don't. Do they have limits on you know, that are based on? Well, we may not want to, you know, print this because of for safety issues or things like that. What kind of limits does Amazon put on this?
So there's a lot of the same limits that you'll see in a lot of other retail locations. You won't see you know, weapons or anything like that being printed or, you know, so, you know, customized or anything like that. Most of what you're going to see, at least until, you know, some of the larger manufacturers get involved, are trinkets, you know, cufflinks and toys and, you know, art. There are a couple of places that are selling, you know, various pieces of art that can be mounted on your wall at home that you can customize. And so I think we will see mostly that for, you know, the first little while. And once some of the companies that have larger 3D printers see that there's profit to be made here, then they may get more involved and do, you know, larger objects, you know, cups and things like that. Things that would normally be, you know, kind of generic things that you would purchase in you know, bulk, or that would be sold in bulk, but can now be completely personalized to, you know, whatever you want.
Where what's the next step beyond this? You know, you had said that, you know, that there are, you know, bigger, better things coming in this regard of 3D printing. What do you see coming down the road on this?
Well, there's two really interesting directions when it comes to 3D printing. The first is the actual printers becoming less expensive so that they can be added to the home and people can decide to do whatever they want with them. Because as great an idea as placing an order on Amazon and having it delivered is, it seems like it would be a lot better for the consumer if you could simply download a design and have it printed in your house 2 or 3 hours later. The problem that we're facing with that is the other area that Amazon is going to be able to kind of flourish in, is that as these 3D printers get smaller, they become as they become cheaper, they also become smaller and in many cases less capable than some of these larger, more expensive machines. And so, you know, you may only see the less expensive machines capable of, you know, printing one color at a time or, you know, doing very, very simple things that aren't really consumer grade as far as something you would buy in a store. And that's, you know, the other direction that Amazon is heading is taking these 3D printed objects and increasing their quality to a point where they're indistinguishable from something you would pick up at, you know, Best Buy or Walmart.
We've got a caller that just called in, Pat from Columbus. Pat, welcome to the show. What's your question for Russell Holly?
Well, I have a completely basic question. When one uses a 3D printer, what actually is printed? Is it a pattern, or can you clarify that?
Sure, sure. Hey, so in many cases, what happens with 3D printers is it's a three-dimensional image that gets printed in layers. So you think about a piece of plastic being kind of heated and pushed through, like the head of a needle, and it gets these individual dots get placed in a flat line, and then that line gets stacked on top of one another until a three-dimensional image is created. So it basically, what we're thinking about, in most cases it's plastic, but in some cases it's also metal. These objects get heated and kind of molded into the shape that you have given the computer instructions to form.
And we're actually also seeing some of this being done on the industrial level as well, aren't we?
Oh, the industrial industry has taken this by storm. A lot of things get prototyped in 3D printers now. Vehicles, a lot of the stuff for the most recent Mars rover was prototyped over and over and over again in 3D printers because it can be done quickly and it can be done efficiently. And in many cases, to very similar specifications to the final product. And in some cases, we're seeing, final products coming out of 3D printers. I think that on a wider scale, that's probably still a couple of years down the road, but it's definitely the direction that we're heading in.
I'm thinking of, I had a friend whose father worked in the auto industry who was a designer, and I'm thinking, boy, there goes the old clay models. You don't need to mold in clay anymore. You can just, program it in and send it to the printer, and there you go.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in many cases, the 3D modeling allows you to be more accurate and move immediately to things like aerodynamics tests and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's move on a little bit. There's another thing out there called travel by drone that allows users to travel without leaving their computers. So explain a little bit how that works and what the advantages are to that.
Sure. I've always thought that it was fun to kind of sit down with my kids and pick a random place on Google Earth and kind of zoom in real close and see this top-down satellite view of this place that we'd never been to before. And travel by drone takes that, kind of one step further by allowing people who have, unmanned vehicles with cameras on them to capture video of areas and then upload them for other people to watch. So what you get are these kind of, virtual tours that where you're basically just following the path of this quadcopter with a camera attached to it. And it's, just hundreds of locations all over the world where you can see, Paris at night or, just anywhere where someone has uploaded a video. It's after checking out the service myself, it's very simple to upload a video if you have, one of these quadcopter setups with a camera. And the quality is often pretty good because a lot of the people who are doing this as, kind of a hobby have put a decent amount of money into the camera as well. So it ends up being a really fun experience.
Do you see something like this, perhaps even linking up with the travel industry and hotel industry, kind of linking, hey, if you really want to see what our hotel looks like or what the city we want you to come visit looks like, press this link on our website.
I think in a lot of cases, this has already happened for some of the more exotic, locations, only in the form of helicopter tours.
Mm-hmm.
Where high definition cameras have been sent up in helicopters to tour some of these more exotic locations. And this, takes the cost of that and shrinks it down so much because some of these quadcopters can be purchased for a couple $100s mm-hmm. and the camera for just about the same. And you can capture a lot of the same quality once you are comfortable enough with the flight. Mm-hmm. So, I think that it's an interesting shift as we see, kind of video camera technology move up to 4K recording and 4K broadcasting, that things like this are basically trivial because they can be done in 1080p and they can they look nice in the process.
What's the cost for the service?
No,
or is
I
there any cost for a service?
I think that that using it is you know, it's ad supported, so it's mostly free.
Right.
And then uploading the videos themselves, you have to have an account to upload the videos, and there are some size adjustments that are requested to be made. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, as far as the actual service itself, this is very much like Google Earth, where you can just kind of go and wander around and enjoy it.
Who monitors the site and kind of, you know, rides herd over what gets posted?
Well, so Travel by Drone is their own company, and they are kind of the gatekeepers there. They maintain everything that gets put up on their site, and the map is something where you can gain information about the recording before you decide to watch it. It's a very simple layout.
Hey, let me backtrack a little bit here, going back to the 3D printers. And Bob, I apologize, we're kind of moving along here, but Bob from Columbus, I see that you've got a call up on the line. And very quick, what's your question for Russell?
Good morning, everyone. Russell, I'm curious about material limitations. You talked about a bubblehead printer. I can understand how we can print the head and the body, but what about the spring steel that supports the head? Are there material limitations on what these printers can print right now?
Well, so there are some 3D printers that mess with metal, but I think in a lot of cases they either are purchasing the springs from a third party or making the springs out of a less capable plastic. Because there are several plastics that can be used that are flexible and can be manipulated in a very similar fashion to kind of basic springs. So it wouldn't be like the traditional bobblehead, where it's got that heavy duty steel spring on the inside in most cases. But with the right 3D printer, it's still something that is certainly possible. Those are just usually a lot more expensive.
And thanks, Bob, for your question. And Russell, let's move on here. Verizon is making some data changes, or data service changes. What are those new changes? Who is it going to affect?
So if you are a Verizon Wireless user who still has an unlimited data plan, which means you've had your plan with Verizon for a long time and you've got that unlimited data service that they used to offer but no longer do. Starting October 1st, if you use a ton of data and you're in an area where there's a lot of other people being very intensive, there's a good chance that Verizon will, by a process of kind of throttling, make your speed on your phone just a little tiny bit slower to deal with the load that's in the area. And this is something that they weren't previously doing and that they weren't previously capable of doing. Through what they're calling a network optimization policy, it has the potential to affect Verizon Wireless users in busy, congested areas.
And one of the last topics I wanted to try and get to, because we've only got a couple minutes left here. Of course, Comic-Con just wrapped up, and Marvel Comics made a large appearance advertising their upcoming movie, Avengers: Age of Ultron. Why is Comic-Con such a big deal?
Well, in many places, it is the central location for all of these smaller events that spin off. Comic book and animation conventions happen all across the United States all year long, really. And a lot of them, look to Comic-Con as kind of the general large location where all of the, pop culture things that are going to happen for the next year go to kind of show off what's going on.
And not just pop culture, but also technology.
In some cases, technology as well, yeah. Not quite as much this past year as some of the years prior, but definitely a big switch towards new kinds of technology. For example, the Hobbit movie, where they started using the higher frame rate video, was first introduced at Comic-Con. So it ends up being a place where things happen first. You can go and see previews to things first and experience things before they're available on YouTube or in theaters or anything like that.
Russell, thanks for joining us. It's always entertaining to catch up with you and see what's going on in the tech world.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. And Russell Holley is a tech blogger at geek.com. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson. Thanks for joining us today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.